It always seems like there's a new invasive insect to talk about, and today it's the brown marmorated stink bug. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we visit with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Almost 2 years ago now. He generously stops by to talk about insects every couple of months. You may have seen a stink bug in your area, and maybe you didn't even know what it was. That's a possibility. There are maybe some other bugs that are bugging you. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or post an insect photo or question on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
Well, tell us about the brown marmorated stink bug. What does it look like?
Very much like two native species of brown stink bugs. So that's the first one.
I mean,
we've got a whole pile of stink bugs here. Its claim to fame, perspective-wise to me, it invades people's houses like the multicolored Asian lady beetle in the winter. And then in the summer, it attacks fruits and vegetables like Japanese beetles attacks ornamentals. And so it's got a double whammy in it. It's an Asian species, been established in the East Coast now for about 10 years. And even when I was, the last couple of years in the lab, we'd get small numbers. And basically what it was is these bugs crawling around in people's houses in the winter. What are they? And what was somewhat heartening is that the numbers didn't seem to be picking up. And so I was cautiously optimistic. But PJ, who's running the lab now this past winter, saw a real uptake, and be darned if it wasn't in Madison, in kind of the near west side, where people were getting, instead of one or two, we're getting 30 and 40. And so it's starting to suggest it's gaining momentum, and it's just a question. I think we'll have a pretty good handle when we're in January, February, the kind of numbers coming in if this is spread out. We technically have county records in about 9 or 10 counties now, as far north as Green Bay, and mostly in the southeast part of the state.
Do they really stink?
Yes.
And what do they smell like?
Well, it's kind of a nutty flavor, but it's off, you know, and people even complain when they use the shop vac and clean them up that sometimes the smell lasts for a couple of days.
Oh.
If you go on the internet and see some of the incredible, almost science fiction-like pictures going on out east in Maryland and in Pennsylvania and the like, you get an idea of what potentially will take off. And as I said, I have been somewhat pleased that it has not exploded, which you almost would have expected it to, but maybe it's a gradual rise.
Maybe a hard winter could slow them down at least. We don't get many hard winters.
No, and like so many of these insects that, this whole thing of coming in is a way of getting into a more sheltered environment.
Yeah.
So even with a hard winter, I think they're going to be in places that they'll survive.
And, of course, before we go back, we'll get to the phones here in just a second, but the Asian lady beetles and box elder bugs, I was at a restaurant last Sunday, and they were climbing the walls outside.
Yeah, so the box elder, it's kind of time of year thing. You know, it usually starts in September. Asian lady beetle, the trigger always seems to be the first hard freeze, which is about a week ago. And so I've noticed the same thing. When I've been out and about on a good sunny day, things have picked up, and you know, I have yet to see when it really hit the fan in the late 90s and early 2000s. We haven't seen those kind of numbers. But the perspective is instead of 4,000 in your house, there's only 400. That's still way too many insects. And so people are going to continue. And so what you will see on these 60-degree plus sunny days, they're going to be active. You know, you get a 45-degree day and the winds are howling, it'll shut them down. So the activity will really be what weather patterns we see in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
And, you know, just tightening up the house, outside of the house as much as possible, but it's tough to do.
Yeah, it's always the best solution because if you solve the riddle, you're done. You know, the outdoor sprays are effective, but if you don't have them on by now, I'm getting nervous because we already know they've worked under the walls and then the sprays really aren't going to be effective. So, you know, usually the 1st of October is kind of the line in the sand for Asian lady beetles, as far as I'm concerned, or cluster flies and some of these other fall invading critters.
Well, Phil, we have every line full, so let's go to the phones and Charles in Mount Horeb first. Let's see if we can get Charles on the line. Charles, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks for calling.
Good. Thank you. My house in Mount Horrible the last couple of weeks has had, I wouldn't call it an infestation, but I found three or four what looked like larval form of some kind of insect. It's about an inch long. It's brown. It's smooth, not furry. It moves like a caterpillar, curls up like a caterpillar, but I've not seen it before, and it seems I'm only finding it inside.
Okay. So what typically I would ask for here, and it may be a little bit more detail than you can give me, is it will have three pairs of legs up on the front end, like all good insects should. But if it has any additional legs on the abdomen, if it would, it would suggest it's in that caterpillar group. I don't think so, though. If I just had to guess, it sounds like the larvae of a mealworm, which is a type of insect that you would occasionally find in an old bag of dog food, bird seed, something similar. The adult stage is a black beetle that's about an inch long. And so, you know, it's one of these kind of point source problems, if that's, you know, what it fits. It might be worth going on the internet and just look up mealworm and see if it fits that pattern. You know, there isn't really a whole lot more in that inch in plus size you would see. If it was whitish, I'd say it could be the larvae of the Indian meal moth, which is that critter that gets in lots of dry goods and stuff in the pantry. But as I said, I'm leaning towards a beetle larvae. And the most likely one is something like a mealworm that, as I said, you would associate with a forgotten bag. Even mouse bait, to be honest, if it's sitting around long enough, they can come off of that. But, you know, you find out what the food source is, get rid of it, and that should solve it. They're really not destructive. They're really more of a nuisance and a contaminant.
Yeah. If you have a photo, you can shoot it up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show, and we can take a look at it.
Okay. Yeah, I'll take a picture the next time, but I'll go online and take a look, too. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Charles. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to Dan in Mequon next. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me. You know, I've been wondering for years, and I thought I'm going to call this show and get the answer. what's the active ingredient in wasp spray that kills them so effectively? What is it, and what happens to the wasp once it makes contact with the fluid?
Well, many of the sprays have pyrethroid or synthetic pyrethroid insecticides, and what their claim to fame is the instant knockdown, and that's what you're after. And natural pyrethrum does the same thing. That comes from chrysanthemums. The synthetic versions maybe are more biologically active or quicker acting. But honestly, I have seen wasp sprays that are out there that do not have any what you would define as classic insecticides. There's a foam product that I have seen that it has to be solvents that are going in there in tying them up. And I, you know, sometimes even soaps. I can remember being at my daughter's house, and we had a wasp nest that needed to be dealt with. Excuse me. And I used some Formula 409 and as a knockdown, and it really was quite effective. Maybe not quite as fast. So, but this foam spray, it's quite interesting because my colleague and mentor, Chuck Koval, had come into my office one day, and he sprayed a bunch of this foam on my shirt. And I was just kind of hopping around, wondering what he's doing. And within probably about 20 seconds, there was nothing there, no staining, anything. And so, as I said, most of these are soaps if they're not insecticides. The interesting thing, though, is that for nests that you cannot see in the ground or that go in your house, we find that those sprays really don't work very well because it's all contact and you can't seem to get the spray where it is. So when we get into those kind of nests, we have to use more traditional dusts and then dust the entrance. And when the critters come out, then the insecticide will work, but it's not instant. It's a little bit slower working.
So what is it? It just paralyzes them?
It just locks everything up. And it's in the old fly sprays, you know, when you had the can of Raid and the fly went by and you sprayed it and did a triple somersault. That's characteristic of a pyrethroid insecticide. It's quick knockdown. Interesting enough, sometimes insects can revive, but in most cases.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It just depends what the product is and the particular insect sensitivity. But it said you're all about personal protection here, and that's why these aerosol sprays that will shoot 10, 15 feet are really very easy to work with because the critters just don't have a chance to get at you.
Interesting. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Mary in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was just wondering, what do you do with all the Asian beetle, lady beetles that are in the house? And how do you get rid of them once they're in?
And there isn't a real good answer. I mean, some people will pick them up and let them go outside. Some people will use the shop vac. But the story is that for whatever you're seeing, there are far more of them either in your attic space or your wall spaces that will keep coming out. And that's why we often preach that it's all about stopping them on the outside if you're looking for a real control. And said once they get in, you notice it's quite interesting that many of them are on very low energy reserves. And, you know, I'm finding 90% of them dead that have come in the last week. And that's kind of typical. But, you know, it really doesn't do any good to spray because you're not spraying at the heart of the problem, if you think of it that way. And so, as I said, it's just physical, either chop back them up. But the other thing is sometimes you can solve the riddle where they're getting in. I mean, if it's in the living room, it could even be just the ceiling light, you know, and how that there's a hole cut in the ceiling and they're coming out of the attic and working down there. So sometimes people get lucky by putting a piece of tape or other physical methods to keep them at least out of your living space.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Mary. And Betty in Brussels will turn to you now. Hi, Betty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We were doing some fall cleanup, and in the window well, there was this big pile of brown, shiny worms about an inch long, and they were about the size of my fist, and there was hundreds of them. And then my husband noticed that on the south side, on the white wall, they were climbing all the way up to the soffit. And I was told from another neighbor that they were called millipede worms or whatever. I've never seen them before, and they don't climb on the red brick of the house, only the white squared area. And never seen them before, and I don't know how to get rid of them.
Okay, so millipedes are creatures that live in the soil and feed on organic matter. And typically, they behave themselves and stay in the soil, except at times their numbers get so high, they go through this wandering phase. And it typically happens in the late summer and fall. They're doing most of this at night. And when the sun comes up, they tend to accumulate where it's cool, damp, and dark. So the first problem is the source of these could be 300 yards away from your house. And so that poses a problem because it's not like I say, well, you do this and fix it and they go away. You will probably tend to see most of them in places that are cool, damp, and dark. So we get a lot of complaints on cement slabs, you know, garage floors, those kinds of things. The window well probably was a good place to hide out, although, you know, they should be capable of crawling out if they want. The color thing I'm a little surprised at because you would think that there's enough surface cracks and stuff in the brick that they could climb that pretty easily. As I said, what I tend to see is more a compass thing. They're on the north side, not the south side, because the south side would tend to be hot and dry. They don't want it hot and dry. They want it damp and cool as much as possible. So the good news, they don't hurt anything. If they come indoors, they're going to die within a day or two. You know, I'm really leery about spraying. I mean, you can kill a few of them, but as I said, you're not really getting at the source of it, and it's just kind of, again, one of those things, if they're in a place you don't want, you sweep them up, take them somewhere else, and get rid of them. And it will probably continue like many of these fall problems until it finally gets consistently cool enough, you know, below 50 degrees or whatnot, that metabolically they can't move.
Yeah.
You know, and what's going to happen next spring is that when it warms up, you'll start to see some activity again. But I think what you've probably experienced is what you see sometimes is you get this incredible population, and then it might be 15 years before you see it again. I mean, it's not something that always happens, but when it does happen, you can usually identify, you know, old prairies, CRP fields, other soil areas that have large amounts of organic matter where all these millipedes have been breeding. In sandy areas, the people don't know what we're talking about because you don't see millipedes in sand because there's not enough organic matter in that soil to support them.
I wonder if they're crawling up, avoiding the red because that's hotter or warmer.
That could be. That would make more sense than the color side of it, as I said. And you think about it, it's stupid to go way up in a two-story in the soffit because that's not going to be where it's cool. But they're not necessarily real smart. And if you ever really want to get an idea of how many are out there, you go out with a flashlight at 10 o'clock at night, because they said that's when they're really far more active. And as soon as the sun comes up, they're scurrying as quick as they can to crawl underneath something or as I said, get in a place that's staying shady if possible and damp.
Interesting. Thanks.
So don't spray aquarium or anything.
No.
Well, I don't know if you're gaining much. And you know, the problem would be is if you said a lot of them were getting in the house, this is, again, one of those things that what you can caulk. And for millipedes, the weakness of most houses is where your foundation meets the siding. Often they can squeeze up underneath there. And so that's something you can, you know, foam or seal in another manner so they can't push in. And as long as they stay outside, things should be fine.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Betty. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can take an in-depth look at Wisconsin's political scene with the new WPR Politicals or Politics podcast. John K. Wilson hosts Capitol reporting team Sean Johnson and Laurel White for a deep dive into the latest in Badger State politics. You can subscribe or listen at WPR.org/politics. And just a reminder, coming up at 2 today, Kathleen Dunn and her guest have recommendations for your fall reading list, and award-winning author Ann Patchett will also stop by. Right now, we're taking a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin with Phil Pelletieri, and lots of callers online, so we'll go right back to the phones and to Gary in Clam Lake. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Hey, thank you for your show. This is awesome. We had what I would call almost a cloud of snow fleas. I think they're snow fleas that were about the size of a grain of pepper. And I walked out on our porch, a cement deck, and they just kind of moved. You could see them by the actually billions. Any ideas what that's all about?
Well, snow fleas are technically springtails. And it turns out that there is a number of them that are very dark-bodied that you will see in March and April kind of hopping on the top of the snow. And so that's where the name comes from. But you can find springtails at different times of the year. Again, they're a soil creature, and we get these population explosions. Usually it's suggestive of very rich organic soil around. And much like the millipedes, I think they're coming out of the soil and piling up there. And you know, other than sweeping them away, it's a phenomenon that you will see. You know, again, what I have heard speculated is that it's like a population explosion in the environment, and that's what's forcing them out, kind of looking for greener pastures. Now, they're small enough bodied, I have seen them blow large distances. You know, you'll see in the woods sometimes you're walking and they'll be piled up an inch or two deep on one side of the tree. And as I said, it's just the wind kind of piling them up. But they don't bite like fleas. Another place that we see complaints quite commonly, interesting enough, is brand new houses. And I think, again, the disturbance of the soil is what sets up the conditions, and they get lots of springtails very active. And then as things kind of balance out and whatnot, they go away.
Yeah, this is the first time I've seen them this early. I have seen them on the snow, but you could actually sweep them into a pile and then watch them jump and move out like a herd.
Right. Well, you know, in this year being as lush as it is, if this was a dry year, it wouldn't make sense to me. But as lush as it is, I wonder if that's what's fueling this as much as anything else.
Yeah.
Great. Well, yeah, they didn't bother anything. My wife was a little concerned, but other than that, they were kind of fun to watch, really.
Yeah.
You know,
why not?
And when we get complaints in people's houses, it's typically a moisture issue because they don't do well in dry environments. And so usually one of the ways of making life tough on them is to dry things out. But, of course, outdoors that won't happen. And it'll be interesting to see. I would not be surprised if this, you know, February, March again, you kind of see a resurgence of this just because I would suspect many of them that are out there now are going to survive long enough to be active next late winter, early spring.
There we go.
Well, I'm just glad somebody else knew about them.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate the call. Bob in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Larry and Phil. I always enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I've been thinking about this for a long time. Where do the yellow jackets and the hornets and the bees, where do they all go in the fall and the winter? If you take down a big nest and open it up, you don't find anything in there. Where do they all go to?
Right. All the bees and wasps that live in colonies use this trick of having fertilized queens in the fall. They go crawl under a rock or some other protected environment. And then in the spring when they wake up, they have to start everything from scratch. So everything you see in that nest are the daughters of that original queen that comes in. This is the way bumblebees do it, yellow jackets do it, paper wasps do it. The only species of bee that overwinters as a colony or a group are honeybees. And, of course, honeybees have honey as a food source to generate enough heat to get through the winter. That's what honeybees do. And that's the problem with all these other things. There are no food stores. They'd be in big trouble. So usually it gets... used to say the 15th of October, but now with these warmer falls, about the 1st of November, everything is shut down. The critters that were active are starving to death, but the new queens have already set up, you know, and they've probably been hiding for the last 2 or 3 weeks, I would guess, as I said, in the soil,
the rest
other protected
dead.
Environments. They're resting. They're just resting to, and as I said, revive. So their bodies are all full of fat stores. That's the energy they're going to use.
The queens you're talking about.
Yes, the queens.
Yeah. But the rest of them...
rest of them are dead.
Yep.
Well, it's very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Bob. Christy in Chippewa County, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm just curious. This week I'm seeing solo monarchs coming here to feed on native asters. And I understand they leapfrog south and lay eggs as they go, so this monarch wouldn't reach wherever its final destination is. However, is there hope that this single monarch will be successful in its leg of the journey? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
When I see them, I had seen one last week, and it was wondering kind of the same thing, that things are getting late enough that unless the weather is very mild, there's an awful long way for them to travel before they can survive. I do have to relate about 3 weeks ago when I was out and about in Iowa County. We were going along a field edge, and in my 65 years of chasing bugs and whatnot, I have never seen this, but I must have seen, my friend Gary and I must have seen 800 to 900 monarchs, and what they were doing is all roosting along the side of the field, and as we were driving by, it was just unbelievable. And a couple nights later, I was sitting in a tree, and I had about 20 of them roosting in front of me on a dead branch. And it was interesting because one would come in and it would just sit there very quiet. But if another one was flying by, it would start to flutter its wings. And then the next one would land. And so I got a little bit of video. And as I said, I have seen pictures of these in movies and whatnot. I have never experienced those kind of numbers. So it was somewhat heartening. You know, there's all kinds of concerns about what's going on with the monarch. But as I said, that was the biggest congregation and clustering I have ever seen in my career.
That's really cool. Jeff in Fox Lake, hello to you.
Morning, gentlemen. Say, I have a question on a fall phenomenon I've witnessed many times over the years, and it appears to be spider webs. You get a day like today, and I'm not seeing them yet today, but when you're outdoors and it's warmer than usual and relatively quiet, and like everything is just has a spider web draped on it, it's like a single strand, or it's not a built web, and I don't know if that actually comes from spider webs or...
Yes, it does.
Okay.
So the phenomenon is called ballooning, and this is how spiders can move large distances. And so the little tiny spiders basically have an extremely long thread of silk, which gets caught in the wind, and they literally float. And, you know, not all spiders do this in the fall. Some spiders spend the winter as eggs, some as adult spiders, but this is a common phenomena, and you can have tremendous numbers, you know, blowing. And then, of course, the webs get, the strands get caught on things, and you can see that. So, that's
the spider.
That's the way spiders get by. That's the way they fly, if you want to think of it that way.
Now, are they're relocating? These are basically young relocating, and that's where they're going to end up for the winter, wherever they get, if it's a good place, wherever they end up.
Yeah, everything that's out now are very small young spiders. That's how they'll spend the winter, and then they'll start. Versus, you know, the big orb web spiders that are so common in the late summer that make those beautiful webs.
Yeah.
They will die out, but the female will lay an egg sac, and that's how that one will get through the winter, and they'll hatch. And then the baby spiders will start their you know, summer-long development.
All right. Well, thanks. It can be quite an impressive something to witness because you can't walk anywhere. I mean, you literally will have webs on you.
Well, you know,
or the strands.
And again, you'll see pictures sometimes. It reminds you what we do with Halloween with the kids with the fake spider webs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just absolutely white-coated. So, yes, I have had people share pictures like that, even from Wisconsin to me, a number of times in my career.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yep, bye.
Bye. Mary in Madison, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. This question concerns alternating generations of the bumblebee, native Wisconsin bumblebee.
Okay.
And I was wondering, the near queen, what they call a near queen, emerges in the spring and produces all females. And I was wondering, prior to the haploid production of cells, egg cells, fertilization, what has to occur? Does she have a male hormone within her? Or
I'm not totally up to snuff on all the dynamics of bumblebees. Typically what happens with the queens is the queen has been fertilized by the males that were produced in the late summer. And then she stores that sperm, and then she starts laying eggs and raising young. And if she fertilizes the egg, they all are females. Typically, the haploids are males. And so that's when and the thing about many bees is they can determine, and they only produce the males in the late summer and fall, because in bee societies, males are really pretty useless other than for mating purposes. I mean, they don't provide protection to the nest. They don't store food. They don't take care of young. And now in some wasp species, and it wouldn't surprise me, some of the bumblebees, you have kind of secondary queens. But again, without ever mating, the way the sexual system goes, they should only be able to have males. As I said, I'm not aware of any females. No, I shouldn't say that, because there's always exceptions in the insect world. I mean, there are some bee species that are just females, and they always give birth to females. But as I said, if there is a species that typically has a sexual union, it's typically the fertilized eggs are females, and the non-fertilized eggs develop into males.
Hmm.
So in the fall, she picks up the male
sperm?
Right. So what happens is in the fall with the bees and wasps, they produce queens. And the difference between a queen and a worker is diet. It's not fertilization. It's diet. And so the new queens that are not fertilized are supposed to fly off the nest and then find a male from some other nest. So we get some genetic mixing here and then store that sperm for her use all next year.
That makes sense then.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's, males are always a late summer fall phenomena, and their purpose is to mate those new queens that are going to be available to start everything the next year.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Yep. Thank you for calling. And Jim in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi there. Say, we really enjoy your programming, Larry, and this one's particularly interesting.
Thank you.
We couldn't help but listen to it, especially we're coming from, we have a home in upstate New York in the Catskill Mountains, and we're on our way back to Minneapolis, our other home. But the home in upstate, we spent a month or so out there, and we had no problems at all with any kind of insects until about a week ago. And we all of a sudden, we were vacuuming up 20 or 30 houseflies a day. And I don't know where the heck they were coming from. We tried to figure every little angle we could, but to no avail.
Sure. And to be honest, I don't think they're houseflies. They look like them, but they're not. And that's the problem I always had professionally, is somebody had a fly problem, I'd have to ask them to send me the flies so I could make sure. But the pattern is absolutely classic of an animal that we call a cluster fly. Now, the cluster fly looks very similar to housefly. It's just a smidgen bigger. If you have any kind of magnification, what you can tell on them is they have on their thorax or chest a very fine golden hair. And what's different is that they have nothing to do with garbage or animal waste. Cluster flies, by nature, are earthworm parasites. So they lay their eggs, and the maggots kill the earthworms. And in the fall of the year, and by fall, I usually would expect the 1st of August and later, they start seeking shelter. And so you get this huge invasion. Now, typically if somebody called me in the middle of summer and they had a fly problem, I'd suspect a dead animal or a garbage can that they didn't dump.
Sure.
But in the fall, it always turns out to be these cluster flies. And just like the lady beetles and the box elder bugs, they're trying to seek shelter to spend the winter and then wake up again next spring and go do their thing. And so, we always talk about, checking attic vents and soffits and, all kinds of places they can squeeze into. Sure. And now the good news is they're not breeding, but the sheer number sometimes that comes in, people swear they must be breeding in the walls, but that's not it.
Well, it's overwhelming, really.
Yes. And
I
so
think if there's some way to cook them, I
You know, so, you know, what we talk to people about, again, is, you know, if you've got a somebody who you know that is really good at sealing and caulking and understanding the physical dynamics of a house, that's the best solution. If not, you can hire a service to spray outside, and it's a seasonal thing. You know, when somebody says we got to come every month to spray this, that doesn't do you any good because it really is something that has to be done in the late summer, and the sprays both repel and kill them before they get in. But what I would caution you, even this late, is they're already in. So it doesn't do you any good to spray this year. It might be something you might consider next year, as I said, to target that first couple weeks of September as the time to protect the house and stop it before it gets going. Because it, you know, I get this complaint a lot when people in for their hunting cabins is they go there, there's no flies, they light the wood burner and they warm it up, and all of a sudden the flies are coming out like crazy. Well, what's happened, it's finally gotten warm enough that flies can be active, and so that's a common phenomenon.
Wow. So it's a cluster fly. Well, thank you very much. That certainly answers a lot. We do. It's a log cabin, so I'm sure there's plenty of gaps.
more than likely, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. We have something up on Facebook. Our Facebook page from Peter posted a photo of a bunch of box elder bugs, the way it looks. And he says, sadly, they're at the chicken coop, and the chickens won't eat the millions of box elder bugs.
They don't. The chickens don't like the way they taste. This is a native insect. I will tell you, even though I have seen some, I don't expect this to be an atrocious year, because typically, this thing ebbs and flows depending on moisture levels. Its main natural death is from a fungus, and the fungus needs things to be very wet. And it's been wet enough that, you know, the bad years for box elder bugs are dry years because the fungus is not very active. But that being said, you know, you can still get big piles of them. And this insect is foul tasting. That's why it advertises that orangish red color to its body. And chickens, I think, pick up on it pretty quick that this is just not something that's worth tasting. So, you know, again, they will ebb and flow depending on the outside air temperature and the sun. And they're just looking for shelter. And they go through two generations a year. And they will breed on silver maple. Box elder is technically a maple. And so those are the two main host trees that they will go through their reproductive.
And it doesn't make any difference what color the house is or the chicken
coop.
No,
but how much sun it gets. Because that's what they do, is they cluster where it's sunny. And so if you had a home in a total shaded area, you'd see quite a bit less activity.
And here's a photo on our Facebook page Scott sent. It says, Larry, can you help us identify this critter?
So it is a beetle larvae, and I am strongly suspicious it's a firefly larvae. If it's not that, it is the larvae of the glowworm, which is the first cousin. So these are predators, and they feed on snails and slugs and millipedes, depending on what species we've got. And typically they're down in the litter. You know, and so when you're kind of cleaning out the garden and stuff, you might find one. But they hunt at night, so it's not something you usually find out in the day. But they're neat critters.
And Dan posted a nice photo of a green insect, a leaf. So it's 4 inches long, he said.
Right. So this comes out of the group that we call the longhorn grasshoppers. And that includes the katydids and the bush crickets and the like. And, you know, it's quite common, even now on a warm night, you'll hear this funny rattle in a tree. And those are usually the male katydids that are both advertising that this is my tree, and if you're another male, stay out. But they're also looking for a mate. And it's interesting. There's an area about, maybe a three-quarters of a mile from my house that every year I can find and listen to the katydids singing in the late summer and in through fall. And, you know, you go three blocks away and you never hear them. And so I don't know what the dynamic of this. There is kind of a natural area there. This is on the corner of, for those of people in Madison, on Whitney Way and Mineral Point. In there close to, you know, there's, I said, a city park, and that may have something to do with it. But
here's another cool photo. There are a lot of photos up, which is great. Here's one from Ken, this guy is webbed to the outside surface of an office window. Would it be a spider? Would that be the likely culprit?
Yes, definitely. And the critter, from the best I can tell, looks like a western conifer seed bug, or we also call it a leaf-footed bug. And you notice on the hind legs there's this kind of flaring. Yeah. This is another insect that comes in people's houses, but it's never by the bucketful. It's a handful and the like. And much like box elder bug. In fact, they're kind of distant relatives of the box elder bug. And, yeah, unfortunately, it showed up in the spider web, and it will not be leaving, it looks like.
Tom in Buffalo County, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, this summer, it seems, along the Mississippi River here, we've had a problem with everybody having fruit flies in the house. And I just wondered if the conditions this year were different or what's going on. I mean, I've never had them before, and I got them flying around. And my sister-in-law down the river said they're catching 30 and 40 of them by the sink and so what.
Okay, so... You know, I could say that outdoors, will there be more fruit flies because there's lots of lush, wet things? Yes. But when I start hearing about numbers in the house, I start wondering about a source in the house. And what you have to think through on fruit flies is that there needs to be a source of organic matter. There needs to be a source of water, and it has to be overly ripe and fermenting. And so, you know, something as innocent as a pumpkin or a gourd that you bring in and you put in the basement, if that starts to rot, it is honestly fruit fly heaven. And, you know, what I think most people are misled by is if you've got some bananas sitting out on the counter and the fruit flies are flying around it, you think it comes from the bananas, but those, they're not ripe enough, not even clear ripe enough. So as I said, when you start to get this explosion, I'm suspicious something in the house. And I've told the story a number of times here, but... You know, think about something that's got some sugar to it, some moisture. And what happened when my kids were small one time is we gave the kids some Kool-Aid in some paper cups. They left them downstairs. They kind of evaporated. But I was breeding fruit flies out of that Kool-Aid because, again, it was the yeast got associated with the sugar and the like. And so it's a point source problem. And in particular, what I get real suspicious is when it finally gets two or three hard freezes. So we've kind of shut the outside insects off. You're still seeing fruit flies. It's got to be coming from indoors. Yeah. And again, you kind of wonder with the wetness and bringing, you know, tomatoes in now and trying to get them through, you know, ripening in the house and whatnot. Boy, those are potential. Onions, I've seen rotting potatoes being a source of fruit flies. Garbage cans that have stuff caked in the bottom. I've even seen a sour mop, you know, it's spill some orange juice and you clean it up with a mop and you forget to rinse the mop out. Well, there's enough organic matter left there. It's damp enough. The yeast start to go. It starts to ferment and bang, you breed fruit flies.
So it's not a phenomenon that's going on around the state or anything like that.
No.
No, as I said, if you get out in the garden and you find an overly ripe, damaged tomato, will you find fruit flies in there? Yes, you definitely will. But as I said, when you start seeing numbers inside, there's gotta be a reason in a source. And as I said, you almost have to be a detective sometimes to hunt that one down.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, talking about the world of insects. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you along. You can join in. If you have a photo, send it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, the title of the page, or you can email us with a question at talk@wpr.org or phone at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to an email from Leanne. She asks if stink bugs are related to assassin bugs.
They're cousins, but their behavior is quite a bit different because assassin bugs are predators. And to be honest, there are some stink bugs that are predators too, but by general, the family are more plant feeding. So they're all in a group that I know as an entomologist is true bugs, the Hemiptera or Heteroptera, depending on how you want to slice the bread here. Yes, so they're much more closely related compared to a beetle or a butterfly or some of the other groups of insects.
Catherine in Madison has a question. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I have a ladybug mealybug question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, is it true that ladybugs eat mealybugs?
It depends on the species. And generally when you see, like, in an interior plantscape, like Olbert Gardens, when they are bringing in lady beetles to feed on mealybugs, they're bringing a tropical species in, not a native species. Because mealybugs, by nature, are not common in the outdoors in the Midwest. They're more associated with tropical plants. Now, you can go on the internet, and there are biological supply houses that will sell you mealy. One, in fact, is called the Mealybug Destroyer. And that's basically what it focuses on. So if you're looking for biocontrol, yes, it can be used, but you have to make sure that the lady beetle species that you're bringing in matches up with mealybugs.
We have zillions of ladybugs in our house, so I guess they're not the right species.
No, what you have is this multicolored Asian lady beetle that has been kind of a nemesis now for about 20 years, really, in the state. And so what's tough about them is they're variable. They have anywhere from 19 to no dots. There's even a form of them that's black with two red dots. They're all the same species. So when you look at a pile of them, you say, oh, there's different kinds here, but they're really all the same species. And again, their problem is they're not a problem, but what they're trying to do is find shelter. That's why they're coming in your house. And then, unfortunately, from now until next April, you will probably see some lady beetles being active.
Okay, well, that answers my question. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Catherine. Darren in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi there. I had a question about box elder bugs and sort of a secondary question about flies on my vehicle. We live south of Madison in a rural area surrounded by farm field and big chunk of CRP land. We have box elder bugs all over the south side of our house. They also kind of made home on my vehicle and is, you know, trying to wipe them off or anything like that. They always skitter away under cracks and crevices, and they have traveled with me all over the state, and I just, they're all over the car, no matter where I park it, where I go. So I was wondering, what can I do, if there's anything I can do to get them off my vehicle?
Yeah.
And then secondarily, in summers, oftentimes I'll have a lot of flies kind of on near the hood and around the engine on the outside of the vehicle. They just seem to be attracted to that part of the car. Any ideas on that one too?
Well, for the box elder bugs, you know, one of the things you might consider are some of the soap sprays. There are both home remedies you can get on the internet, and there's a product called insecticidal soap. And so when you see them clustered, you spray them and it will kill them. The negative side to it, there's no residual. So if you spray today and they show up tomorrow, it's not going to affect them. But this way, you can get them before they sneak away on you, and I think you'll get some pretty good results. It's funny, though. I tell this story. In fact, it's in my book, if it ever gets written. We were doing the show one day, and a person called from Iowa, and the old remedy from the Iowa State entomologist was a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water, and she related that she tried Cheer, and it didn't work. And the problem is soap chemistries differ versus if you go to the hardware store or more likely probably a plant store and get insecticidal soap, it will always be the right stuff. Whereas the home remedies, I'm never quite sure what's in there to know if it's going to work or not. Now, it gets a little bit more difficult with the flies because, sometimes it's a visual thing. I don't know what fly species involved, but I really don't have a repellent per se.
I think they're cluster flies because they seem to pop out when we get cluster flies at the house.
Okay, the only thing, though, that wouldn't fit, you had mentioned it was the summer, and cluster flies don't start this behavior until really late summer, early fall.
Okay.
You know, the other problem you will get, you know, being in a rural area, there are some species associated with livestock, you know, lesser house fly and face fly and the like. And one of their behaviors is to fly a moderate distance away from where they're breeding and rest in shaded areas. So we get this kind of an accumulation of flies just hanging on things, and it really is quite a nuisance. But, you know, there's not an easy answer. I mean, fine, you can put a fly spray on the wall. But
we do have a chicken coop about, I'd say, 35 feet from where the vehicles are.
Pretty comfortably say it's lesser housefly, because lesser housefly is notorious for being on chicken waste. As I said, one of their behaviors is to just kind of hang on things and create a nuisance. You can try managing and drying out the chicken waste as best you can to make it less suitable, but it always kind of goes hand in hand to some degree.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. And Chris in Sparta. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have a, I think, a bed bug problem. I've been in motelling it quite a bit this summer on the road. And what do they look like, and how do you get rid of them?
Bed bugs.
So, you know, they're shaped, flattened, somewhat like a very small pumpkin seed, but they're kind of a chestnutty brown in color. One of the other characteristics when you get bed bugs really starting to go is they leave little black waste spots along the mattress and the bed frame and the like. It honestly is a type of problem if you have brought bed bugs with you that I would suggest to seek professional help, because anything you buy on the internet or at the hardware store is probably not going to be effective. They are using heat treatments, among other things, and pest control services that have a lot of experience do have some treatments, but it's usually multiple treatments if they're not using the heat to take care of things. And I find the chance of success of doing it yourself. But there's no way I would go through that expense unless I found bed bugs present. I mean, yeah. You know, you worry about people that are spending a lot of money when they have not seen the physical presence of a bed bug. So I would suggest looking on your headboard or along the seams. Probably one of the best places to look, if you've got a box spring, on the corners of the box spring, there's this little plastic corner protector.
Yeah.
Bed bugs just love to hide under there. So I would just kind of tease one back and see if you see any of those very dark black stains, waste stains, or find little critters in there. If you did, then you know you have bed bugs. And you know, one of the interesting things is at least 50% of us don't react to the bites. So people can have bed bugs, unfortunately, feeding on them and breeding in their home and not even know it. And that's one of the explanations of why they often get quite numerous before it catches people's attention.
Interesting. You know, we were doing a show the other day with the author of a book about dogs and how dogs smell. And there are dogs that are trained to actually sniff out bed bugs.
Yeah, that's been a big business, especially for hotels and motels that, you know, are trying to stay proactive. And so they'll rent these dogs once a month, once every 2 months, because they're so much more efficient at going through in sensing where the bed bugs are. But one of the arguments and concerns have been, is how do you certify these dogs? And there have been a couple cases where people have said the dog was trained, the dog wags its tail, they spend this expensive treatment, but they never took the step of verifying that there were bed bugs there. And so in some cases, dogs have gotten a bad reputation, but it's not because the dogs aren't efficient, it's the way they're trained, or some people, again, are really not being honest with people that this is a properly trained dog. And so as I said, if you're going that direction, I'd get a hold of a longstanding company. And there are companies in Wisconsin, a number of them, that have dogs on staff, and you can rent the dog and bring it in to see if dogs will pick it up much quicker than people in much lower numbers.
So Chris could rent a dog.
Yes.
find out if he's actually got bed bugs. There you go, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. Terry in Browntown, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. Roughly maybe 3 months ago, we had found a large caterpillar that was probably at least 3 inches long. So we looked in thinking it's a butterfly, and sure enough, it was a moth. And actually, it had either two or four spikes on the back of its head. They gave the name of it. But could you just comment about them? Because I've seen them in early falls where they're probably dying. Now,
yes.
Will this one survive and make it to another year? But they're just gorgeous, these huge moths.
It's a wild silkworm. You probably had Cecropia. You could have had Luna, Polyphemus. We've got about four species. And the way all of them work is they spend the winter as cocoons. And then the moths hatch in the spring to early summer. They mate. The moths are very short-lived. They don't even have functional mouth parts. They can't eat. So they usually live 4 or 5 days if things are good. Usually they only live a day because the bats love to eat them. Now, there is one exception to this, and there's a very stunning moth called a black witch, and it literally is black with white markings in it, and its native area is southern Texas and Mexico, but I have seen black witches almost every year show up in the state. They blow up here. So that's one that it doesn't really migrate in the sense that it goes back, and the ones that are up here just die, but depending on weather patterns, you can blow them in. But all our native wild silkworms, as I said, their trick is to spend the winter as cocoons, either in the ground, on the surface, or in some cases, the cocoons are spun, especially with Cecropia, in the trees. And they kind of wrap leaves around them. In fact, as a kid, that's what I used to go, is go out and try to collect these Cecropia cocoons, bring them to the house, leave them in a cool spot, and the next spring you're blessed with the adults coming out.
I see. Now, the one I've seen will survive now? It'll go into hibernation? And
No. The one you've seen, as I said, under the best conditions, only lives 3 or 4 days and dies. But it has laid eggs. Those larvae will feed. So if you saw one late this summer, honestly, that's not the typical time. And that was a big mistake on the moth's part, because if it lays eggs, it probably takes the caterpillars at least 3 or 4 weeks to develop. And this late, there's no way that they could develop. The leaves are falling off the trees. So as I said, it was not typical. The typical time you see Cecropias and Lunas and whatnot is usually May and June.
I see. And then you were familiar that it had the horns on top of its head, though?
Oh, yeah. They're
That's what made its name. I can't remember what it was.
Well, there also is a critter called the hickory horn devil. So there's some interesting groups in this wild silkworm one. You know, in the case of Cecropia, it has these big orange and blue spikes sitting up on the front of the, you know, just behind the head. And there are other species, and, you know, one that's become more common is the imperial moth up here.
Yeah, so there you go. Thank you so much for calling, Terry. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, he'll be with us right till 12:30 or so. We'll take a look at the news, and then we will be back with Phil. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus with the University of Wisconsin Department of Plant Entomology. I almost said plant pathology. Entomology, and of course, University of Wisconsin Extension. So great to have him along. And lines are all filled. The number is 1-800-642-1234. And we've had some emails. Ben emailed to ask if Phil has any information on the flesh-eating screwworm that's killing key deer in Florida.
Sure. So in the entomological world, there is something called secondary screwworms, which are not much of an issue. But the primary screwworm historically was established in the United States. It was an agricultural pest because if a cow or whatnot had just a minor wound, the fly would lay its eggs, the maggots would migrate. And so in the case of when they dehorn cattle and whatnot, they would migrate in the brain and kill the cows. Interesting enough, that insect was eliminated from the United States by the use of a sterile male technique where they released millions and millions of male flies that had been irradiated. So they were sterile. They mated with the females. They didn't lay eggs. And so it was considered eradicated all the way down into central Illinois or central Mexico. So that was kind of where the red line was. Well, now just recently they have somehow become reestablished, and why they're finding is, among other things, dead deer for the same reason. These maggots are migrating, getting in the brain cavities and other things and killing the deer. And so it looks like the USDA is going to have to ramp up again and reinvest in eradicating this. As I said, it will be a problem in the southern part of the U.S. in particular. Never was an issue in Wisconsin, but both wildlife and agricultural animals are potentially susceptible to primary screwworm.
Stacy in Madison has a question for you. Thanks for calling, Stacy. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering about some bug bites my husband and I received this summer while we were landscaping. We pulled out a barberry bush. Later that night, I noticed bug bites all over my thighs and my stomach. My husband had the same thing. And we had no idea there were even bugs around us. We never felt them. We never saw them. What do you think that could have been?
Well, chiggers is the first thing that comes to mind, although it's more of a guess. In particular, if it was something like black flies or other things, you would expect it to be reoccurring. But what chiggers are little parasitic mites that typically attack insects. And what happens if you run into them is you do not feel the bite. What's quite characteristic, the bites seem to be in places where clothing is confined, so along the waistline, the sock line, and the like. And What's crazy about chigger bites is they burrow in. They don't like the way we taste. They back out, but they leave enough debris behind that's what your body reacts to. So there's this delayed reaction sometimes of hours, sometimes even a day or two. They tend to itch like the Dickens and weep and you know, really a very uncomfortable experience. But the thing is that they're not even there anymore. They have backed out and left. And so typically you get it when you're working outdoors. They're hard to predict, but if my personal experience is I find them in raspberry patches and whatnot for some reason. And again, I think it's just the environment that supports the mites and the things that they prey upon. So it's a bit of a guess, but I would suspect it could be chiggers. You know, one of the things you can do if you get in an area you suspect chiggers have been is as soon as you're done, take your clothes off, go in and take a brisk shower, do a good toweling off. And what you're often doing is removing the mites before they get an opportunity to burrow in. And so that would be one of these.
Are these chiggers like tiny, tiny red dots?
Yes. And they are bright red. That's the interesting thing about it. Now, there are other mites you find in soil that are bright red that are not chiggers. But they're a bright red about the size of a small period in a newspaper, maybe even a smidgen smaller than that. So you can see how they're overlooked. And as I said, classically, you do not feel this burrowing sensation, but you react to it a few hours later.
Well, you described it perfectly. How do you get rid of them? Because every time I weed, that happens.
Okay, so one of the things you might consider, you know, typically I don't like to spray for things like this. You might try, though, just try some soapy water spray into that soil area, because that's where I would expect them to be, in the mulch area. If that doesn't work, then you can go probably one step up. There are outdoor landscape sprays. One spray a year should be more than sufficient. They're not something that breeds really quick. But I think I'd try the soap, you know, spray once just to see if you can knock them down. I know if the chigger mite is in front of you and you get the soapy water spray on it, you will kill it.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Pam in Verona, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I am so excited to be able to talk to Phil. I've had this question ever since we got to witness this. Mid-September, we were watching the monarchs collect across the prairie. We were by our library. They would collect from across the prairie and land on the trees to do the roosting, but they were coming from such a great distance away that where Phil had referred to before that, you know, they'd flutter and it maybe was giving a signal. These would seem to be too far away for other butterflies to see, but they would come and be by the hundreds. And so we were wondering, how do the butterflies know where to keep coming back each night? And they were doing that for a period of weeks.
Well, you know, there are documented roosting trees. You know, and it has to be something physically of, you know, what they present in the landscape that attracts them. And then, of course, as I said, when I had mentioned my experience, I just think the butterfly was coming to a tree that looked appealing to roost. And then it saw a congregation of butterflies on the one branch, and then it kind of collected there. But as I said, you know, in the migratory patterns, I used to get this call quite a bit along the lakeshore. You know, from Green Bay down to Milwaukee, mm-hmm. where people would say, you know, every year we've been lucky enough to have these trees right by the lakeshore that every evening it's full of monarchs. And so it's a real neat experience if you can see it.
It is. Mm-hmm.
And as I said, it was just even I had never been lucky enough to really physically be there when that was happening. And that was my experience this year. So, as I said, it really
cool.
was fun.
It is very cool. So thank you. So these would be trees that we could be watching like then every year to see if they're
yes,
part of the migratory. Okay. Well, we'll watch for that next year. Thank you so much for answering the question.
Yeah. Sure. Thanks, Pam. Thanks for calling. And Stan in Neshota, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hello, Larry and Phil. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good, because I'm on Bluetooth. I didn't know if you'd hear me. I have something I've been wanting to ask you about. I had a vacation home on a lake just about 10 miles south of Wisconsin Rapids. And some years ago, I was painting the outside of it. And about 3 or 4 feet next to me on the wall on the outside, I noticed what looked like a stick. And it was about maybe seven or eight inches long. And I thought it was unusual. This stick was on the side of the building. And then it started moving. And I realized I thought it was what's called a walking stick. And I didn't know or I didn't realize that maybe there's such a thing in Wisconsin. And it was very unusual looking and just unusual to see it. So I've been wondering, is that possible in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we have four species that I'm aware of walking sticks. The typical ones are found in oak woods and get upwards of maybe about 4 to 5 inches. But I'm not aware quite up in your area, but in the Devil's Lake area, there is a remnant population of giant walking sticks. And it's the only place that I'm aware of it's in the state, and those things would approach 9 to 10 inches. They're typically found in Missouri and places, it's more of a southern creature, but we do have this remnant population. And so, whether it's one of the other species or the giant walking stick, what's typical of the giant walking sticks is you get these reddish streaks up by the legs. Almost looks like somebody's painted with a magic marker. In fact, the first time I had seen one, somebody had sent me a picture, and more than once on my career, people would send me things as jokes. And I was not aware that we had this population, and I went up to the museum we have in the department, and sure enough, we had records of giant walking sticks. And as I said, if you normally would look for them, you'd have to get into areas in southern Missouri and in south. So it could have been a giant walking stick. If not, as I said, it was one of the other native species.
There we go.
This one, as I recall, it was totally brown. And the location would be probably about 30 miles north of Wisconsin Dells.
Yeah, no, we have, and at times it's a weird phenomenon, but you get these outbreaks of walking sticks where literally they will defoliate the forest if it's oak trees.
Wow.
And people talk about when they're laying eggs and their weight's coming down, it sounds like it's raining all the time. It's not really common, but I'd say once every 4 or 5 years, we get little outbreak pockets in the state. When these things are just not moving and whatnot, they're so well camouflaged, they're easily overlooked. So I guess I'm saying they're a lot more common than people think, but they're not so easy to observe.
Oh, there we go. Thanks so much for calling, Stan. Appreciate your call. I want to give Tracy in Laval a chance to join us. Hi, Tracy. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. My question is there a fly that lives in the feathers of birds, specifically ruff grouse? When I have cleaned ruff grouse in the past, not every time, but once in a while, there's a fly that's maybe about a quarter inch long, comes flying out. I was wondering if...
Yes. And yeah. It's a parasitic fly, and there's a handful of species on various birds that you see, and they're very strange looking things.
Yeah.
In fact, one of them I've seen referred to as a grouse fly, very flattened. They're just bizarre looking little things, and people sometimes when they're cleaning birds, I wouldn't be surprised if one of these tries to take a little nip out of somebody, just because.
Yeah.
It's at least possible, but it's not their nature to bite people. As I said, they burrow in the feathers and live on the bird a good portion of the time as a blood-feeding parasite.
Maybe that might be something that causes a cycle in the population.
It would be a valid question because, of course, insects are often vectors of diseases, although, maybe Dr. Craven could give us some hint, but I don't think they have as much impact. As I said, at least I'm not aware of any diseases that have been associated with them that we could equate with the grouse cycles.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Tracy. Appreciate the call. And Richard in Clio, Alabama. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Hey, I had a question because... I know Florida. I come here, and Florida's got love bugs here. They do havoc on the paint on a vehicle. And someone told me that they were by the University of
Oh.
Okay, I'm losing, but from what I can deduce, that the University of Florida was responsible for them. No, they're a native insect. And they get the name love bug because many times when you find them, they are coupled. And as you say, one of the problems with insects at times when you get, and we've seen this up here with mayflies, is if you get them on the hood of a car, the proteins and stuff in the blood can literally etch the paint. And so, you don't normally think of insects being a problem that way, but these love bugs, when you go through clouds of them, I mean, your car just gets plastered with them. And again, it does seem to be, but no, this is a native insect and University of Florida, although I have seen T-shirts from the University of Florida with love bugs on them because it's such a Florida thing.
Yeah.
But it really has nothing to do with the government or a university being involved with the establishment.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate the call. Mark and Baldwin, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. There is a small flying insect, about a quarter of an inch long, that looks exactly like a tiny bee. It hovers. It kind of behaves like a hummingbird, and I have no idea what it is.
Okay. What I'm guessing is it looks kind of like a bumblebee, or smaller.
Yeah.
Okay.
Smaller.
I mean, the first thing I was going to is there's a whole family of things called hoverflies that are bee mimics. But when you said it was more like a hummingbird, there is a clear-winged sphinx moth called the hummingbird moth. And it is about the size of a bumblebee. You would see it feeding on flowers during the day. Honestly, it breeds on honeysuckle, which is a common plant, both in the woods and in people's gardens at times. Whereas the hoverfly family, they can range in the size from honeybee to a little bit bigger to even quite a bit smaller. And when you watch them, the name hoverfly is extremely descriptive of how they fly. They just kind of sit there in midair and then kind of zing back and forth.
And these are about a quarter inch long, as Mark says.
Okay, yeah. So that sounds more like a hoverfly, whereas I would describe the moth species as probably about an inch long in body form. And as I said, your first take is the bumblebee. But then when you look the way it flies, it's more hummingbird-like. Versus a bumblebee is just kind of more loping along. So
there you go. Thanks, Mark. Emily in Independence. Hello.
Hello. Welcome. There. Thank you for having me on the show. Not welcome. I guess I welcome myself tonight.
That's all right.
I have a question. I'm building a greenhouse, and I would love to have some type of insect. Honeybee would be great if that worked out. It would be dual purpose, but something to help pollinate my plants.
Okay, so typically what they use instead of honeybees are bumblebees. But what you do is you buy the bumblebee kit, and they ship you a nest. And they, this really kind of took off when we started greenhouse tomatoes in the state and elsewhere in the Midwest. And so the pollinators that I'm aware of in greenhouses have always been bumblebees. Honeybees are just too hard to manipulate, I think, in that environment, whereas bumblebees seem to do better.
Okay. I'm allergic to bees. Is that something I should be? Are there less aggressive forms?
The tough thing, and you might want to talk to your allergist about this, different bees have different venoms. And typically when people say they're allergic to bees, what they're allergic to is yellow jacket stings. Because yellow jackets are far more likely to sting people and stuff, but people refer to anything that stings as a bee. Whereas being allergic to straight bumblebees would be less common just because become allergic, you've got to get stung in the first place. And bumblebees by nature, unless you sit on one, they just don't really go out of their way to sting you. Whereas yellow jackets, sometimes you just look cross-eyed at them and they seem to want to pick on you. But as I said, that might be worth discussing with your allergist because the venoms are different, which means people's sensitivities are different. And as I said, my experience is most people really are allergic to wasp stings and not bee stings.
Do you have any suggestions for where to start looking for a bumblebee kit that would be reputable?
Yeah, honestly, I think on the internet you can go and just, most people that are doing this, there's a sad side story to this in that, there's a number of our native bumblebee species that have really been in population declines for about 15 years. And one of the speculations is that they are declining from a disease that was brought to us from Europe. Those were bumblebees that were raised, American bumblebees that were raised in Europe to bring back here for pollination services. And we think that's how the disease got introduced and then it got out in nature. But there are two or three species that are quite common. So as I said, I think if you look on the internet and you will see companies that provide bumblebees, along with the instructions, it's going to be seasonal. Typically, this is more late winter, early spring when the pollination, so people are trying to get crops ahead of what we can grow outside. But I'm sure you can get bumblebees any time of the year from some of these services.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. David in Dairyland, hello to you.
Hello, hello. Thanks for taking the call. I'll get right to it. I live in Dairyland. I'm about 40 miles south of Superior. I've been here for 40 years. I've driven back and forth to Superior numerous times. And 40 years ago, I used to have to clean my windshield when I got to Superior. And on the way home, when I got home, I'd have to clean the windshield. I'd have so many bugs, they'd be sick. Now I can go practically the whole summer without having to clean my windshield. This seems serious, and I don't know if you know how what impact it has on birds, but certainly it seems there are fewer bugs.
It could be, and this, of course, food sources for birds would be a factor. But the only other thought that comes to mind to me in that time span, I wonder if the forest and other areas have matured to a point that they're no longer as supportive, you know, as trees get older and, you know, yeah. Much like we know with deer populations and everything else, the dynamics that when you get in a more stable, mature forest, there's less diversity versus more disturbed land and whatnot would have higher numbers. So that's just, you know, kind of a random thought of what may be an explanation is among other things, because I don't know of any references to a drastic reduction in insect numbers. I mean, there always seems to be insects around. One of the things we're witnessing is a little bit of a shift of more southern insects moving into the state, meaning I'm sure some of the northern insects are being pushed out of the state just because of climate issues. But, you know, with 25,000 species plus in the state, you would still think there's something that would be doing well. And as I said, so I just go back to maybe, you know, the change in the maturing of the forest may have as much to do with it as anything else.
Yeah, it's maybe the aerodynamics of cars, too.
That would be an interesting one.
As a possibility, too. Well, thanks, David, for calling. And let's see, we got a quick one here from Gina with a photo. Oh, my gosh. What can you tell me about this huge pile of black worms?
That is our millipede friend that we talked about earlier. And again, it's a classic place to congregate. It's a nice, cool slab. And so people would mistakenly treat the slab, and they're not coming from the concrete. They're coming, you know, and crawling in from distances away. So it's probably as easy to sweep them. And I'd get them a good distance away from the house, because if you got a bunch of dead millipedes in a bucket, they will smell. They're very high in fat and the like. And so, as I said, I have pictures even more dramatic of this in my files that people have sent me. And if you experience it, it's like a science fiction movie. I mean, it's hard to believe there's that many creatures out there.
And box elder bugs, somebody wondered where they actually come from. Are they native?
Yes, that's a native insect.
So we can't blame them on anybody. We can't blame them on anybody else. Okay, well, Phil, it's always a pleasure. Gosh, you're going to be back, let's see, on December 21st.
The day after my anniversary.
Oh, and just a few days before Christmas. So that's going to be fun, too. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Nice to be here.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate, emeritus professor. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. Great to have him with us, and he'll be back on December 21st. Just taking a look ahead at what we've got coming up tomorrow at this time, our vehicle maintenance expert will be back. We had a lot of fun with him last time he was here. He's going to talk about what you should be doing to get ready for winter driving, among other things. So I hope you can join us for that. And he'll talk about your own car issues as well, I'm sure. And in the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.